The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. And we very much want you to do that this week because in a couple of weeks, we're going to be airing a special episode of the podcast called Faster Proof, in which we try and answer as many of your stupid or bizarre or brain-puzzling questions as possible. So if there's a question you've always wanted to answer and just couldn't find an answer for it, it's not as easily Googleable, give it to us and we will run with it. Kids questions, stupid questions, philosophical questions, anything you like, send it on to us and we'll do our best to answer them in a special episode called Faster Proof. But you just have this week to send them in. science@newstalk.com. Now, during the week, we witnessed the FameLab Ireland final, and congratulations must go to Simon Spychak, this year's Grand Master Champion. He is a researcher from APC and studies the microbiome, and his talk was about zombies.
I'm a zombie, but don't you worry. There's no need to run off to the supermarket and buy up all the toilet paper to hide in your secret underground bunker, of course, because you are a zombie too. Now, despite what all these books and TV shows and movies would have you believe about zombies, one teeny tiny little microbe can't control the human body. In actuality, it's actually trillions of microbes that are subtly pulling the strings. What do I mean? Well, believe it or not, there's trillions of these teeny tiny bacteria and viruses and all kinds of microorganisms as diverse as the colors on my shirt that decide to move into our bodies, right? Now, a lot of them, in fact trillions, decide to move into our gastrointestinal tract because, as we all know, from real estate, the most important things are location, location, location. And boy, is the gastrointestinal tract a fantastic one, because these microbes, not only do they live rent-free, but it's nice and warm in the gastrointestinal tract. And even better, when we eat food, sometimes our body doesn't digest at all, and these microbes that are there, they can actually digest some of this food, such as the fibers you might find in the sourdough bread that you're cooking during lockdown. But aside from just eating your food and not paying rent, they can also metabolize these foods that we can't normally digest. And they can produce these molecules. They can produce a plethora, a cornucopia of these beautiful, diverse molecules. And a lot of these molecules can actually signal with the human body. Isn't that exciting? Can you believe that some of these molecules can help regulate our immune system development, our stress response, and they might be involved in our mood? In fact, there's so many different diseases where the microbes in the gut are clearly different than those in healthy people, indicating that the microbes in our gut might be important for a whole host of these diseases and disorders, including anxiety, depression, neurodegenerative disease. In fact, we're trying to figure out how to use diet to change the microbes in our gut so that they can produce the molecules that we need to improve our mental health. Thank you. This has been a message from a trillion microbes in a man suit.
Congratulations to Simon, who goes on to represent Ireland at the FameLab International Final. Thanks to British Council and Cheltenham Festivals. Now it's time to look back at the week's science news, and joining me in studio to discuss all of that is Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD. You're both very welcome. Our first story. It's about dinosaurs. And I know that we've been covering COVID-19 stuff, as everyone else has, and often we talk about brain discoveries and cancer discoveries. But I have to say, we never start with a dinosaur story because it generally tends not to be the biggest story of the week. But this I really like, Ruth. It's to do with the Spinosaurus.
It's to do with a Spinosaurus. And Jonathan, I know you have a lot of dinosaur experts living in your house, so I'm a bit nervous talking to you about this one. But a Spinosaurus, for people who haven't followed all of the Jurassic Park movies, is an enormous meat-eating dinosaur that lived about 100 million years ago. And for decades, scientists have thought that it was quite similar to a T-Rex. So it's the same sort of family of true dinosaurs, the theropods. And these are dinosaurs that have hips a bit like us. They're bipedal and they stand up straight. But what was unusual about Spinosaurus is that it had this enormous sail on its back. So the vertebra on its back had these very long projections sticking up. So this dinosaur had this huge sail, and that's what it was thought to have looked like for the last number of decades. And the first skeleton of Spinosaurus was discovered about 100 years ago in Egypt by a German archaeologist. But actually that good skeleton was was destroyed in World War II when the museum in Germany where it was bombed. So scientists just had the notes from that archaeologist to look at from that person. So since then, there's been a few other dinosaurs found, but about in 2018, an archaeologist called Nizar Ibrahim followed up a lead. So he had been in a market in Morocco and he bought some dinosaur fossils, and there is a big market for fossils.
This is a movie script right here, isn't it? It's got World War II, it's got markets in Morocco. It's like the backdrop to Indiana Jones.
Movie. Indiana Jones, eat your heart out. So he had found these interesting bits of fossil from the back of the Spinosaurus, and he'd always been fascinated by them. So he actually went back and followed up with this fossil. I think he got the first one about 15 years ago, but he went back in 2008 and went back to the area where these have been found with a big team, and they did this grueling work where they used they had to move huge amounts of earth, but they came across an almost complete Spinosaurus spine. And there's an amazing video if you go to the National Geographic website, because they found vertebrae and they just kept digging around them, and what they found is all the way down into the tail these enormous spines projecting out of the tail. And actually, when you see the reconstruction of the tail of this dinosaur, it almost looks like a fish skeleton when you see it in a cartoon and all of the meat has been taken off it. So this tail looks like a huge, big, long paddle that goes out at the end of this dinosaur. And so, of course, what they have surmised is that this dinosaur was aquatic, or it certainly spent a lot of its time in the water. And it's the first true dinosaur that's been found that's aquatic, or at least spending a lot of time in the water.
So this to me is huge because, as you say, my younger son, Cohen, is dinosaur mad, and we have a Spinosaurus at home, and it is very much on land and does not have this sort of a tail. So first question is, because when it comes to fossils this old, there's always a bit of gray area. First question, do we know this is the same species? We do know this is a Spinosaurus.
We do. I mean, since that original discovery back 100 years ago, they have found other pieces of these dinosaurs, and they have been able to put some of the pieces together. And in fact, those notes from that original find were very good. So they can compare the vertebrae of this current find with those previous ones. So they're pretty confident. This man has been looking at Spinosauruses for a long time. But I think the other thing that they did that was really interesting was that they actually went to researchers in Harvard, and they essentially got them to make reconstructions of the tail and look to see how it would function in water. So they compared it against tails of things like crocodiles and newts. And in fact, it looks like it would be an incredibly efficient swimming machine and well able to be a pretty ferocious predator in rivers. And in fact, the area of Morocco where they found the fossil was known to have been a mass of rivers around 100 million years ago. So it's really, really exciting. I mean, actually, when I looked at this first, I thought, but I'm sure there was loads of other dinosaurs that swam, because we, you know, you hear about the Plesiosaurus and the Ichthyosaurus, see them. Yeah, but in fact, they are reptiles, but they're not dinosaurs, which I didn't know. So to be a true dinosaur, you have to have these bipedal hips. So things like a crocodile where your thigh bones
bird
stick
hips
out laterally. Exactly. So, I mean, exactly, bird hips.
Why didn't we know this sooner? I know we had small bits, but we had an idea of what the Spinosaur looked like. Were there not other clues in the physiology that would have given that away? Clearly not.
Well, I think actually when you look back, there were. So in fact, what we see was, I mean, but again, I suppose the teeth, for example, look very much like a crocodile's teeth. They look like they would be adapted to biting and grabbing, you know, and would be useful for fishing. But I suppose it wasn't that people didn't think that this creature ever went into the water.
Right.
But what it's this idea that it really probably was mostly water dwelling,
Okay.
that's new. And I think, you know, those it was always it has been thought until now that theropod dinosaurs essentially flew and went on land, but really had not colonized the sea.
Right.
But it also comes down to just how much we still have to learn. I mean, when you're talking about 100 million years ago, a lot of what we have is very incomplete. So I suppose it's also important to keep asking those questions.
Shane, our second story, I think, has huge creative potential, and it's about glowing plants.
Yeah, so there are certain species out there that can do what's called bioluminescence, which is that they give off light due to a chemical reaction. So we see this in algae, we see it in certain types of jellyfish. We also see it in certain species of mushroom that live in the tropics. And so researchers in Imperial College London have taken some of the genes from those mushrooms and they've put them into tobacco plants and they've made the plant glow. They've made it give off light. And that's absolutely incredible.
Now, is this not something that has been done before, transferring the sort of light-making genes into other plants?
Not at a genetic level. So what's happened before is that you may remember we covered a story on self-illuminating Christmas trees a few years ago,
Yeah.
where they took molecules from species that bioluminesce, they put them onto nanomaterials, and then they put those into the Christmas tree. And the nanoparticles had the bioluminescent molecules on them, and they glow. And so the tree glows, but it wasn't really inserting the genetic material of one species into another. And so that's what they've done here. And what's different here is that, well, firstly, you don't have to put in an invasive species like a nanoparticle. And secondly, it's far more efficient because they're utilizing a fuel within the plant that is able to sustain and make the bioluminescent material, which is called luciferin, which I think is a kind of cool name.
Yeah.
I looked it up to see did it have some sort of like devil-like origins, but unfortunately, it doesn't.
With this, could you actually make the trees that line a street glow rather than those horrible halogen lamps?
You might be able to, however, that may not be a good idea. And that's not what the main goal of the researchers has been. So, why that wouldn't be a good idea, I suppose, is that if you interfere with the natural setup of plants, the way they produce food and grow could be interfered with. So that it generally wouldn't be seen as a good idea to Yeah, unfortunately. However, what this is like, it's a new way to do science, right? So when you think about the number of ways that we're able to look into the human body without cutting it open, and some of those involve light, that this is a way of doing that in plant species. So you can add this genetic material into your plant, and you could light up certain parts of the plant, and so then you can see how it responds to various stresses or changes in the environment. And so it's a way for us to look at the biology, the botany that's happening within plants without having to cut them open and do nasty things to them.
When you say nasty things, like the idea that I could have a bonsai tree that also served as a nightlight, I mean, who is that harming?
Well, you see, I said, but what it's harming the tree potentially. So, like
But it's
trees
one
grow.
tree, like we eat plants all the time. That harms them. I think this is great creative and commercial potential.
It is, however, I suppose it's you know, it does to me have the sense of the beginning of a sci-fi movie that's going to go horribly wrong. So I
That's
think
why
at
you're not a biologist, Shane.
the
Sorry, Ruth,
Absolutely.
what were you saying?
Well, I was going to say, you know, I think that the luciferase enzyme has been used in mice, you know, as a reporter gene. So this idea that when scientists want to know if a certain other gene is active in an animal in the lab, that they can get it to glow. So, I mean, yeah, I'm actually really surprised that this is the first time it's been done in plants because it's been used in biology for a long time. But yeah, I can imagine the interior decorating potential is huge.
Ruth, our third story has to do with more spines. And this time it's a rather more grisly story about rats.
Well, it isn't really grisly, I think, to be fair. So this is research from the University of Illinois, from Martha Gillette's lab. And these researchers have created what they are calling spinobots. And in fact, this is a type of biological robot that they've been working on. And we've all heard about muscles being grown in the lab, you know, even talking about muscles being grown for meat. But researchers have, of course, also been trying to grow muscle in the lab in the hopes that we may be able to use it as potentially replacement muscle for people when they have damage to their muscle tissue. But they've also been looking at, obviously, muscle for movement. And researchers have been able to grow muscle in the lab, and they can get that muscle to contract and move. But obviously that's not happening in the ordered way it happens in the body. So what they've done here is they've printed a little sort of scaffold. And if you imagine a tiny little piece of hose pipe, just a few millimeters across, with two little posts coming down, one at each end, and a little foot type structure at the end of each one of those posts. They then put muscle tissue onto that structure. Now, the muscle, once it grows, will twitch and move a little bit, and the little legs that are hanging down can move. But in this case, the researchers took it a step further from that original biobot that they called it. They took a small piece of spinal cord from a rat, the lumbar spine, the bottom of the spine that controls the hind legs. Now, they were able to keep that spinal cord tissue alive and implant it into that little piece of hose pipe. They then were able to keep all of that tissue alive together, and the neural tissue from the spinal cord grew out and attached neurons into the muscle tissue. And then when they found is that actually there was rhythmic contraction of the muscle, and that was being mediated by the nerves in the spinal cord. So this was really, really exciting, because we were getting these two types of tissue to function together. And they were able to show that by adding different chemicals, what we call neurotransmitters, so chemicals that act on the nerves, they were able to get a sort of gait-like walk from these tiny little, as they call them now, spinobots. So the reason this is so exciting is that obviously we have a lot of conditions, you know, things like motor neuron disease, where it's the peripheral nervous system, the nerves that go out from the central spinal cord in the brain, that maybe are damaged. So this provides a potential way for researchers to study them more easily, but also potentially to think about replacement in the future.
I have to say, I find that quite grisly, to be honest. The idea that you're splicing out a bit of a rat spine and it's growing onto the scaffold and suddenly it comes alive. That's, I mean, you've obviously got a harder stomach than I have, Ruth.
Well, that's why you're not the biologist, John.
Ah, very good. Yeah, well, you were just waiting for that, weren't you?
I was waiting
for your moment. Shane, our final story has to do with, I don't know, this seems like, of all the fake near miss stories, to me, this seems like a relatively near miss.
I think this is a story that's just reminding everyone that it's not just the biologists that hold all the scientific doomsday cards. Astrophysicists can be quite scary too. So maybe you'll have heard of the idea of a PHO, which is a potentially hazardous object. And it refers to giant rocks in space that might come very, very close to the Earth. And next Wednesday, we're going to have a bit of a flyby from a rock numbered 52768 1998 OR2, a great name. And it's 2 kilometers in diameter, so it's pretty big, but it's not as big as the asteroid that hit the Earth and killed the dinosaurs. And it's going to pass by on Wednesday. It'll come closest at 5 to 11 on Wednesday morning, British Standard Time. And it's going to be 6.2 million kilometers away, which is 16 times further from the Earth than the Moon is, which is pretty close, but it's going by pretty quick. It's going to go by at 30,000 kilometers per hour.
Oh, I thought I did my maths wrong. I thought it was closer than that. That's not that close, is it really?
Well, it's pretty close. And so what happens is these things...
I should have done the arithmetic before putting this in. Is that close?
Well, it is. You see, these things come in cycles. And so the next time it comes around, worryingly, it's going to be 3 times closer. But that's not going to be until 2079. The estimate is it's going to be 3 times closer. So scientists are going to track its flyby next Wednesday very carefully just in case it's going to be even closer the next time around, because, you know, these things don't hit us very often. But when a rock this large does hit the Earth, we can see from Ruth's story at the top of the show that these things can have pretty dramatic consequences for species that live on the Earth.
Yeah, but it doesn't have to hit us to cause catastrophic effects, right? If it hit the moon, that would be pretty bad. Is there any effect that could happen from it just getting very, very close but not actually hitting, in terms of pulling us off course, or is that too small?
No, it would be too small for it to affect the path of the Earth. The only thing I can think of, perhaps, is a very, very small effect on the tide. But I have to imagine it would be pretty brief and pretty small in effect.
Right.
Still, pretty cool, though, right?
Yeah, I don't think we need any more peril in our lives, or potential peril right now, guys.
Yeah. I agreed. Thanks, Ruth. Thanks, Shane. Now, around about this time last year, we talked about the detrimental effects of noise in our lives with Matthias Basner. But if noise can have physiological effects that go way beyond our auditory system, what can silence do? And I mean real silence. Steve Orfield is president of Orfield Laboratories, where the quietest place on Earth can be found. He joins me now. Steve, you're very welcome to the programme. As soon as I heard about your lab, I was fascinated by it. Before we talk about the inside, maybe you might explain the outside and what this place looks like.
Yes, the Anechoic Chamber is part of a federally accredited acoustical lab in Minneapolis, near the downtown area. It has three reverberation rooms, and it has an anechoic chamber. And the reverberation chambers are highly reflective, extremely reflective, and the anechoic chamber is extremely dead. When you approach the anechoic chamber, it's a steel room. It's built of two levels of walls. Each of the walls is two layers of steel with insulation between them. And each of the walls is separated from each other, so the interior and the exterior wall do not touch. As you walk through the two doors and you walk to the inside of the chamber, you're standing on an airplane cable wire floor. And on all sides of you are 1 meter deep fiberglass wedges. So you have wedges pointing at you from every direction, from the floor, from the walls, from the ceiling. And what an anechoic chamber is it's a room that has zero reflections or 100% absorption in the frequency range in which we use it.
Right. When you say you have near complete absorption, what exactly does that mean when we think about the sound waves that come from the reverberation of air? When they come out of our vocal cords, that air, and it's pushed out, that vibration wave, where does it go and how is it absorbed?
Well, in most rooms, if you and I were talking, the sound would come out of your mouth and it would come toward me, but it would also hit the walls and the ceiling. And the combination of the reflections from the walls and the ceiling and the direct sound from your voice would create the room effect of your voice. Much like when you're in a shower, you'll find at certain frequencies in a given shower, it tends to boost your voice and it really sounds nice to sing. And those are the resonant frequencies, or the frequencies at which the dimensions of the room match the frequencies. So in any room, you get a room effect. And the more reverberant the room is, the larger the room effect. And the anechoic chamber is a place with no room effect. It's the only place in the world you can go to where you will hear no reflections of your voice.
But it's not just your voice, it's nothing, right? What does that feel like to be in a room where nothing is coming back at you in terms of sound?
It feels like you have pressure on your ears, but actually you've got pressure removed from your ears. Sound is technically called sound pressure level. And so the pressure of the sound impinges on your ears, and that's what produces the sensation of sound. And so this is a room where essentially nothing is impinging on your ears but the sound of your own body. So as you move into an anechoic chamber and you're quiet in that chamber, within about 20 seconds you can hear the sound that your ears begin to make when there isn't any sound. So your perceptual systems will always create self-stimulation if, in fact, you have no real stimulation. So you could hear the buzzing and the wishing in your ears. And the longer you stay, the more it's obvious.
What do you mean the buzzing and the wishing in your ears?
Well, your ears are make sounds that are the sounds that avoid the brain from processing nothing.
What?
And so,
how did I not know this? So our ears make noise.
Yeah, our ears are both microphones and loudspeakers.
So the purpose of the noise that our ears make, is that like a noise canceling thing, or what is it for?
No. What our ears are doing is our brain wants to be stimulated in the auditory region of the brain. And so if you don't produce sounds, pretty soon your ears will produce either sounds from quieter sounds like your body, or they'll produce hallucinogenic sounds, which are sounds that don't exist.
Wow. So let's talk about the sounds that do exist first. Exactly how long does it take to start hearing things like the heart pounding in your own chest?
It's usually about a 20 minutes to a half an hour in silence. In other words, having gone into the chamber, having not talked, having not made any sound, about 20 to 30 minutes later, you begin to hear your heartbeat. You begin to hear the sounds of your elbows and your knees as the joints rub against each other. You begin to hear the sounds of your heart beating from your carotid arteries in your neck. And if your hearing is very good, by 30, 40 minutes, you can hear the flowing of the air in and out of your lungs.
Wow. I'm trying to figure out why you would build something like this, except as a torture chamber. Are there aeronautical applications of this? Is it used to reduce vibration, or is it used in space exploration?
Well, in space exploration, NASA is very interested in anechoic chambers because space is anechoic.
Yeah.
So when you go into space, there is no sound. And so your ears adapt to a much quieter level or a more sensitive level. So we used to think 30 years ago that your ears had a fixed threshold, and once you got below that, they couldn't hear things. And now we know that the quieter it gets, the more sensitive your ears are if you're not experiencing significant hearing loss. And so as astronauts go into space, the devices in the space station, which sounded rather quiet on Earth, sound very noisy. And so they've now been working on the sound quality of many of the devices in space. And of course, as you get out for a spacewalk, you hear nothing essentially except the oxygen flowing to your body when you're on a spacewalk. So it's much like a submarine, where when you enlist in the military and you get on your first submarine cruise, you're going to be under the water for about 6 months. You're never going to see any daylight. You're going to always have the same background sound. And you have to pick certain kinds of people who are not bothered by the lack of daylight or are not bothered by the lack of sound. And then you have to train them. So at NASA, they take the astronauts, they put them into spacesuits, and then they put them into saltwater tanks in an anechoic chamber. And they wait to see how quickly hallucinations are developed, because they know that you're going to have hallucinations in space. And they want to know that if you're going through hallucinations, you've got the wherewithal to continue your work.
I'm glad you reminded me, because we were talking about the sounds you could hear, and I'd forgotten to ask you about the sounds you don't hear. What sort of hallucinations do people have when their brain starts to fill in the gap that is normally filled with environmental noise?
Well, they can range. I mean, you can have sounds that your ears produce, and those sounds like tinnitus. And people think that tinnitus is a neurological sound, but it's actually a physical sound. And so if I put a sensitive tube mic in your ears and you were hearing tinnitus, I could measure and record the tinnitus. And so there's a series of sounds that are produced by the ears. And then, of course, there's a series of sounds that are produced in the brain, and those can be most anything.
Tell me a bit about perceptual silence.
Well, we're the only multi-sensory independent design research lab in the world. And that means that rather than focusing on sound or focusing on light or focusing on thermal environment, we have an expertise across all the areas of human perception. And so when we talk about silence, we often remind people who like to think of silence as sound that there's quiet and there's noise in every area of human sensation. So if you're an older person walking down a corridor in a nursing home, you might have bright lights, and the brightness of those lights is visual noise. Mm. Visual noise may disable you the same as acoustical noise might. Or you might have thermal noise, which is a draft that causes you to be cold. And so what we decided close to 50 years ago when we started our company was that we didn't want to work in the area of perception and do any harm. We didn't want to be very good at acoustics, but cause problems in areas we didn't understand. And so we became the only lab in the world that developed a specialty in all the areas of perception. And we call the quiet coming from taking down all the stimuli as perceptual quiet or perceptual silence.
You've also done work with people living with autism. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. About 15 years ago, we started studying populations that had perceptual or cognitive disabilities. And that includes the elderly, includes people with dementia, and includes people with autism, sensory processing disorder, PTSD, ADHD, blindness, deafness. And so our interest was in developing universal design standards that could be used to design buildings for the 40 to 50% of all of us who have cognitive or perceptual disabilities.
Can you tell us about some of the experiences of people who have those disabilities or experience the world differently to us? What sort of experiences have they had in your facility?
Well, if you bring someone in who's autistic, and we spent 2 years researching autism, people with autism who go into the chamber tend to feel extremely positive about the experience of being in the chamber. And in as little as a half an hour, they will come out and sit down with me and tell me that their brains have not felt so good in 5 or 6 years. In the area of dementia, we developed the world's first standards for multisensory standards for 90-year-olds with dementia. And we developed a campus in Iowa in the United States, which is the first campus in the world to design buildings to reverse the sensory losses of the elderly so that they can function better as older people with very little sensory sensitivity and with cognitive problems at the same time. And so we designed a campus for Western Home Communities, a nonprofit in Iowa, that has about 500 people on their campus. And we moved about 30 of those people into these new standalone buildings we designed where all the sensory stimuli were dramatically reduced. And what we were trying to do, we were trying to increase the sensitivity of the elderly people by about 300%. Because when you get to be 90, you're operating at about 10% of your perceptual sensitivity when you were 20. And when that facility opened, and it's the first attempt in the world to do this, when that facility opened, the nurses started reporting to their supervisors that people who were poor eaters were all of a sudden eating voraciously. People who never talked were starting conversations and starting to interact with their mates at the tables. And everyone was starting to operate as if they had far less dementia disability as they were thought to have.
Wow. It's interesting that I haven't heard a take on that actually sometimes we might be thinking about someone's abilities in a way that's slightly slanted because of their actual physical environment.
Well, that's incredibly true. I mean, when we started studying disabilities, I had to understand the construct of a disability. And what I came to was that none of us are disabled. We all are able people with certain filters. So if you're autistic, you have a filter related to social parsing. You have a filter related to repetitiveness. You have a filter related to being extremely good at hyper-focusing. If you have dementia, you have a filter related to cognitive processing. If you're just older, if you're just 90 years old and you don't have dementia, you still are in sensory deprivation because your perceptual systems are only operating at 10% of what they used to.
Yeah.
So you can't sense most things. So one of the things we've been trying to do with dementia and aging is to explain to the gerontology field that dementia isn't a separate illness from aging. Dementia is mainly aging plus a filter related to cognitive confusion.
I wanted to ask you about your reverb chamber. That sounds like almost the opposite of the silent chamber. What is done there, and what's the point of that?
Reverb chambers are designed to be completely diffuse environments. That means that in our main 200 cubic meter reverb chamber, if I stand right next to you and talk, and then I go 25 feet away and talk, my voice is exactly the same level to you, because the reverb chambers make everything even all over.
What? So the same volume, you mean?
Yes. Yeah, I can whisper right next to you in a reverb, in my reverb chamber, my main reverb chamber, and then I can go close to 30 feet away from you and I can whisper, and you hear the same level of loudness in both cases.
How is that possible?
Well, it's possible because the chamber is designed to be close to 100% reflective in the frequencies of interest, much like the anechoic chamber in its frequencies. So the chamber is a perfect reflector for your voice, and as a result, sound evens out all across the room. Our main reverb room has a 4.5 second echo. And so if I spoke loudly to you close up and loudly to you at a distance, the decibel level would be the same, but the clarity would be different.
Right.
It's much like stadiums. When we developed, when the Metrodome was the largest sports facility in Minnesota, we developed Rock Band performance standards, and we measured the football and baseball teams in that arena. And for the Rock Bands, we worked with Pink Floyd and a number of other major bands, because Bob Dylan had performed there and had a terrible concert because the space wasn't designed very well. So what we taught Pink Floyd about was how to create sound systems that had what's called a very high director reverberant ratio, meaning the amount of sound that came to you as a listener versus the sound that bounced off the building and then came to you. The relationship was much more toward the direct sound, because the higher the direct sound is, the more clarity you have.
Yeah. Wow. That's pretty cool. And so what's that chamber used for?
Those chambers are mainly used for standardized testing. So it's usually a lot of architectural testing. So we test gypsum board walls, we test doors, we test windows for sound transmission. And then for sound absorption, for example, if I want to find out what the seats in a music hall are going to do acoustically to the hall, I bring those seats into the reverb room and test them for sound absorption.
Right.
And then third, many companies need to have a sound power rating on products to ship them to other countries. And so we do all kinds of sound power testing on devices that are being shipped from the US to Europe and Asia.
You know, as someone who has always been interested in sound, both music and radio, and how we hear, I have to put anechoic chamber on my bucket list of things to visit and things to do. But for the moment, Steve Orfield, president of Orfield Laboratories, in Minnesota. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
If you like that, you might like a piece we did a while back with Matthias Basner about how sound can kill you. That's on our Future Proof Extra podcast. It'll be available this Tuesday. All right, it's time to look back at some of your emails and texts and tweets from last week's podcast. And also we have a request for you as well. Aidan McKelvey, producer of the program, joins me by Skype to go
Hello.
Through some of these things. Hi, how are you? Good?
Not too bad.
It's nice to have you back. It's a bit of texture in the podcast, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm always going on about texture, aren't I?
It's good to be back. Yeah. I've really been missing my own voice when editing it in the last few weeks.
this piece really could have done with a lot more me.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So we were talking about COVID-19, of course, because we always do. And John in Partree, Mayo. I don't know where Partree is in Mayo. Do you know where Partree is, Aidan?
No, my Mayo knowledge is poor.
Yeah.
If it's not Ballina, I don't know where it is.
Right. Well, Westport is in Mayo, isn't it?
Well, that's true. That's true. Yeah. I've actually played a gig there before, so I should know where that is.
Yeah, yeah. Although it's all a blurry mess, right?
Yeah, rock and roll. Yeah.
Someone says, we were talking about injecting bleach, and this is what Trump had sort of, I mean, he didn't say will you just check and see if injecting bleach, he said something along those lines, and looked at Deborah Birks and said, you know, will you look into that? And of course, that was a big controversy last week. And we said, just don't do that, obviously, because it was the next day. And John says, Jonathan, if you inject someone with disinfectant, you can be charged with bleach of the peace or domestos violence. Very good. Thank you very much for this, John. Nice puns. We were talking about the moon and landing stuff there. And apparently we've landed a few bits on the moon that haven't got as much recognition, perhaps, as they should. And Shane, our physicist, said, you know, the moon gives us, you know, the tides, and it gives us the seasons and so on, and it's really important to us. He said something like that, and Kevin in Old Town was picking him up. He said, hang on, the moon just gives us the tides. It's the inclination of the Earth's orbit relative to the vertical axis of the sun that causes the seasons. Yes, this is true. Although that's very good specific language. Whenever I'm trying to explain this to my kids, I say, look, it's just because it's wobbly a bit. It's a bit wobbly as it goes round. But yes, it is the inclination of the Earth's orbit relative to the vertical axis of the sun that gives us the seasons. But the moon gives us more than the tides, isn't it, Aidan? It gives us craziness.
It gives us light. Howling. At night.
Light at night,
it gives us werewolves.
Yeah. So actually, loads. And then
of our listeners in the last few weeks, even though there's like a pandemic going on, and it's this unprecedented time in human history, lots of them are still managing to find the time to be concerned about little points of terminology. Like last week's person who gave out yards to you for calling it the dark side of the moon. I love that. I think that's
what,
like,
what was wrong with that, though? It is the dark side of the moon, isn't it?
I don't know. Like, I think that, yeah, like, officially, if you're talking about the geographical area, maybe it's the far side of the moon. But, I mean, everybody calls it the dark side of the moon. Like, yeah. I think she was saying that it's not dark in and of itself. It's only dark to us because it's facing away from us.
But that makes it dark.
Yeah, I know.
And when you think about, like, light is, you know, it, light doesn't exist. We've created it as something we perceive. It's just different wavelengths. It really is no such thing as darkness or lightness. Is that right? Have I talked myself into not making any sense? Probably have. Moving on before we examine that statement too closely. We got another text in, which seems to be completely random, on some band called The Gandhis, saying, Dear Future Proof, why have all the videos from The Gandhis disappeared from YouTube? And then lots of exclamation marks. So I have no idea what this text is about or why we would be some sort of expert on this band. But Aidan, maybe you have some...
Yeah, this looks highly suspicious now. I just want to point out to the listeners that you contacted me without seeing this text and asked me to come back and do the text with you this week.
I did.
It just so happened that one of our fans, I was in a band called The Gandhis many years ago.
My wife is a fan.
Is she? Well, that's great. Maybe it was her who texted
it
in.
It wasn't.
I think it's a great opportunity for us to play out on the Gandhis song. And just for our future listener...
We've never played out on a song before. This isn't down to business.
Yeah, but it's different times, man. Different times. And I need that. I need those royalty checks big time.
Excellent.
You know, like, we're all struggling a bit here.
Right. So why have all your videos been taken down? Is it inappropriate content? Are you ripping off other people's riffs? What is it?
No, I don't know. I actually saw it and went, what? And then I looked it up and no, they're there. I think maybe because it's something that's not that well searched for and probably not optimized. So if you search The Gandhis, you're almost certainly going to get some sort of video relating to Gandhi, the historical figure.
Yeah.
And because nobody's been watching them recently, I'd say they've gone down the pecking order.
One of the reasons why maybe it wasn't the best choice of band name.
Yeah. That and the fact that nobody can spell it.
Yeah.
Which was a constant issue for us.
You need to pick a word for a band that instantly people know A, how to spell it, and B, it's no other word. Like Flirtox.
That might work. I mean,
it's not a great band name, but like, no, but it's search engine optimized, man. We live in a digital age.
Yeah.
This is, by the way,
I'm learning this hopefully on my third or fourth band because, I've made that mistake a few times or similar mistakes.
This, by the way, is well below the level of banter you can expect in Aidan's other podcast. Which is episode 2 is out, right?
Episode 2 is out, yeah.
Tell us about it.
Yeah, it's Double Think. The episode is called What is Good? And it's basically one of the most fundamental questions in moral philosophy. And we have the most famous philosopher living today, I believe, A.C. Grayling, is on the podcast with us. Yeah, so that was pretty fancy of us. And guaranteed, at the end of it, you will be able to answer in one line, what is good?
That
is not a guarantee. It's a philosophy podcast. Of course you won't be able to. You'll get no answer.
I was like, I thought that was a point of view sort of thing. Okay, so check it out. It's called Double Think. You can find it wherever you find your podcasts. So finally, we have an ask from you, and I think we probably should... Look, I'll let you in on the secret. We're recording this before we record the intro, but I guess now I'm thinking about leaving this kind of important piece of content past the crap about the Gandhis that no one's going to listen to. We should probably put this at the front of the podcast as well. So you're hearing this for the second time, but I'm seeing it for the first time. We're looking for your questions that you can't answer, and they can be about anything that is vaguely scientific.
Yeah, and these are kind of questions that sometimes when we're trying to think of pieces to be on Future Proof, you come up with a question and maybe it's just a little too hypothetical or frankly stupid to do a full feature piece on Future Proof. So we've kind of accumulated a few ourselves, but we're looking for your questions. One that came to mind for me was, why, if the boiling point of water is 100 degrees, do your clothes dry on the line? So... those sorts of ridiculous questions.
That's an excellent question.
Yes.
I have no idea. We will investigate that for sure.
Yes.
So we want you to ask your questions, and they can be really stupid. That's okay. But they have to be sort of questions that you can't easily Google. They can't have to be ones you can't easily figure out. So get them into us. You can email us science@newstalk.com, and we'll try and fit as many of those into a very exciting upcoming episode of the program. It's called Faster Proof. See what we did there? It's very clever. Right. With that awkward silence means we've come to the end of the podcast. Aidan McKelvey was producing. On sound was Jojo Cardozo. Simon Keane was researching. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
You can't do this to me. I know we just don't have the heart. Baby, baby, what if we don't pretend?